performing ministry responsibilities with confidence. Number 4. The minister juggles several responsibilities or roles during the wedding ceremony. First, the minister wears the hat of priest. Priests lead the congregation in worship, and after all, the wedding ceremony should bring glory and honor to God. Priests give prayers and priests give blessings for both the couple and the congregation. Priests mediate between God and earth, that is to say, they join together what God has sealed in heaven. Second, the minister wears the hat of master of ceremonies. The bride has the spotlight, but the pastor is the director of activities. And as master of ceremonies, pastors gather the people together, welcome the congregation, set the tone for the occasion, and direct everyone through the entire ceremony. And you've heard it said that it ain't over till the fat lady sings. Well, in a sense, the wedding isn't over till the pastor sings. And it isn't done until the master of ceremonies says it's over. Third, the minister wears the hat of emissary of God. The minister represents God, especially to those who only enter a church during a wedding or a funeral. Your demeanor, your actions, your behavior, and your attitudes speak volumes to these people about ministers and the God they claim to know and serve. It is an opportunity to make their contact with a minister a positive experience, which might soften them to the church and to God and to the good news of the gospel. As a representative of God, weddings provide a strategic opportunity to share the gospel and the meaning of a Christian marriage in non-threatening ways. Fourth, the minister wears the hat of diplomatist. There may be some tense situations with fraternities, maybe a nasty photographer, maybe some relatives with their nose out of joint. Or maybe there's some other parties whose actions are bringing grief to the wedding. And as a diplomatist, you will have to resolve disputes in a very tactful manner with kid gloves to maintain order and authority and to set the record straight. Pastors are often concerned with their wedding sermon. And with the increased use of video recording devices, what you say at the wedding will be replayed often. I discuss the message with Christian couples. I ask them what they want the message to reflect and if they have any specific passages or any specific verses that they would like incorporated into the message. I certainly don't let them dictate what I say, but I do seek their input. First of all, the sermon should be short. My sister's wedding was videotaped, and the pastor performing the wedding spoke for 20 to 25 minutes. He was the father of the groom and must have been very, very nervous. And the longer he spoke, the more restless the congregation became. At the beginning of the sermon, the couple's heads were lifted high with excitement. By the end of the sermon, however, the video revealed the couple's head to be lowered almost with chin resting on chest. And it was a clear sign of boredom from a long-winded sermon. So 5 to 10 minutes is sufficient. Second, be optimistic with the tone of your message. Now, I've attended weddings where pastors spoke so much about the terrible state of marriage that I wondered why they were even performing the ceremony. I mean, if it's that bad, and if it's that awful, then why in the world are they involved in it? Marriage really is actually a wonderful experience. It is God created and God instituted and God made, and what God makes is good. And the pitfalls should have been discussed in premarital counseling, not during the sermon. This is a happy occasion. Put everything in the positive. Instead of speaking about what is wrong with marriages, speak about how the couple can build a strong marriage in Christ In other words, keep a positive, optimistic tone. I've gone to some weddings that were real downers that maybe should have been funerals. So be optimistic with your message. Third, keep the sermon biblical and personal. It is fine to read scripture and speak of God in the sermon. As a matter of fact, it is expected. The Bible should be brought into the message, without a doubt. And a personal touch keeps your sermon from becoming another redundant message that could have applied to anybody. Use the couple's first names. Address them personally. Fit the sermon to them and their uniqueness rather than them to your sermon. It is quite all right to take a generic outline or a sermon and then refit it for your needs. Take something that is already somewhat developed and refit it. Reorganize it. Fine-tune it so that it's not your generic message, but very fine-tuned to meet a specific couple. The point is to make it personable for the couple. The sermon should also contain an address to the congregation as well. After all, they are there as witnesses supporting the union. Addressing them specifically involves them in the ceremony and keeps their attention. So a wedding sermon should be biblical and include remarks to both the congregation and the couple. Fourth, it is okay to use appropriate humor in the message. To become the court jester is certainly out of place, but a funny comment or a funny story that pertains to the couple or to your message is certainly appropriate. Humor injected at the right time and appropriately keeps everyone's attention. It takes the edge off of the tension, and it helps to solidify the group. And it can be very, very effective. The components of a typical wedding ceremony usually include the following events. The prelude is music played prior to the start of the ceremony. Postlude is music played after the ceremony. There's the lighting of the candles and the seating of the parents and the grandparents. You will also find special music. You'll find the processional. That is where the bridesmaids and groomsmen, bride and father walk down the center aisle. The betrothal, or the giving away of the bride by the father, is another element of a typical wedding that you will find. You'll find congregational hymns. Obviously, you'll find the wedding sermon. There will be wedding vows and the exchange of rings. There will be prayer, lighting of the unity candle, and there will be a benediction. There will be a presentation of the couple and a recessional. And these items make up the typical wedding ceremony, although they can be placed in various orders of arrangement. In your traditional and typical wedding, you will find these elements. May I suggest two essential areas that I feel are extremely helpful to the smooth success of the wedding? The first is the wedding coordinator. Even in small churches, a wedding coordinator can take a large amount of work off the pastor's hands and care for wedding details with great precision. Find a lady who not only desires this type of involvement, but is gifted for it as well. Match interest and zeal with giftedness, and you have a magnificent person for the job. This person should be well-versed in the planning and carrying out of weddings, so she might be a resource for the couple. And she would know what equipment the church owns, where it's located, and she would basically be the person from the church who helps with the wedding details for the engaged couple. She is the point man, in a sense, who recruits, helps, and gets the wheels rolling. And this person really is worth her weight in gold. The right person in this position frees the pastor to focus on other ministry duties. And the right person in this position allows the wedding coordinator to utilize her interest and her giftedness for the blessing of others. For the married couple to have someone who knows where things are, how things are to be, it is an absolute blessing for the welfare of the wedding ceremony. The right person in this position also helps the church as a whole be more productive and efficient with this aspect of ministry. The second necessary item is a church wedding handbook. This provides the couple with the necessary information regarding premarital counseling, the wedding plans, the fees, church policies, and any other pertinent data helpful to the couple. Developing a wedding booklet was one of the most practical things I ever created in ministry. And there was one for church members, and we also had one for non-members. And when someone came in to ask about a wedding, it was quite easy. If they were a church member, we just handed them the correct wedding handbook, and they went home and looked it over. And we didn't have to spend our time answering their questions when they could read it from the book. When there is no set policy that is written in black and white for everyone to see, then everyone has different ideas regarding policy details. There is no standard whereby everyone is treated the same, which can produce rifts and tension within the body. So a wedding booklet avoids these problems. Have the church leadership establish a relevant group of people to draft a policy for presentation to the leadership. This way they are working under the authority of the church, which adds authenticity to their work. It will only become official when the church leadership officially approves it. You want it to be a group decision to alleviate any perception that this is only the pastor's pet project. And those attempting to develop the policy should include persons who have interest or insight into the issues, such as the custodian, maybe someone from the ladies group, someone in charge of the kitchen, maybe a deacon, a deaconess, and others who provide for a well-rounded and informed group. If you don't already have a wedding handbook for your church, it will be worth your time to develop one. The wedding arena is not without its sticky issues. For instance, the different views surrounding divorce and remarriage seem to be as numerous as the circumstances surrounding divorce. Pastors in the same denomination even take different stands. And that's confusing for the church, and it's also confusing for those who seek to become married in that particular church. And if the pastor's view differs from the view of church leaders, then what is to be done? Now, I certainly don't pretend to have all the answers, but I have discovered some very helpful things to do. First, share your view of divorce and remarriage with the leaders of your church. State your view as clearly as possible and as non-threatening as possible either. Don't state it as this is the way it is and you have no say and it's either this way, you live with it or get out. Obviously, you'll alienate people and it won't be in your best interest. But state your view tactfully and also give a reason why you support that view. You see, just because the pastor believes it doesn't mean that it's true. You need to bring some support and say, this is why I believe this particular view is the right view. Let the leadership know that you have thought long and hard over the issue and your conclusions have merit. This isn't something that flippantly came to you overnight. And then discuss the issue, discuss its complexities, and discuss its pitfalls for you as a pastor. Second, work with the elders to develop a policy regarding divorce and remarriage after a thorough study. Take your time and do a thorough job. Make sure the policy reflects the findings of the group. If all you want them to do is support what you believe is true, then there's going to be no support for the policy. Lead them and guide them, but let them think and let them create for greater ownership. Even if your denomination has an official position, I think it is wise to study it and discuss it, because people need to think through the issue. They need to own it and have a rationale behind it. It's not good enough nowadays to say, well, I believe this because my denomination says I should believe it. Get people to study it and look at it and examine it. And get them involved in creating decisions, because people tend to support what they themselves have created. The heat will be off you, you see, if you get others involved. And when you say no to Susie's wedding on biblical grounds, you will have the backing of the elders. And it'll be a group decision, and they will know that why you made a decision, how you based your decision upon the biblical grounds, and it's something that you have discussed, and they have confidence in you. And they support you, and they back you. So, discussing the issue openly and arriving at a church statement helps preclude problems that would otherwise fester into hornet's nests. Well, what if the woman is pregnant? Will you perform her wedding? Will you marry two non-believers together? Will you marry a believer to a non-believer? Will you marry someone who meets all the requirements, but you just don't have a peace in your heart about the wedding? I mean, they say they know Christ, and apparently from what you can tell, yes, they are believers, but there's something inside of your spirit that doesn't set right. Do you do the wedding? Do you see yourself as a servant of the state, a representative of God, or possibly both? Have you thought about the ceremony to renew marriage vows? Are you going to do that? What's the purpose of that? Is it really right to say your vows twice? Well, these are sticky issues that need to be thought out and examined long before you're placed in the hot seat. I encourage you to gather wedding manuals from several denominations and publishers for variety in your arsenal. Some of the women's magazines print wedding planners that may also be helpful. And all of this helps keep you fresh and on top of things. The same wedding service over and over and over again is about as tasty as a stale piece of bread. So don't do it. Be fresh. Finally, be kind and considerate when working with other ministers. If you are asked to perform the ceremony in another church, find out why that pastor is not performing the ceremony. Are there problems that need to be ironed out? Ask that minister's permission to perform the ceremony in his church. I believe that this is courteous and respectful. We don't want any rifts between ministers in the same town. We want them working together. And so if I'm performing a wedding at another church, I always ask the reason why they're not having the home church pastor do it. And most often, there is a very good and legitimate reason. And I feel very comfortable doing the wedding. But it's wise to call the pastor up and ask him about it, and so that he does not feel offended whatsoever. Well, there is a great deal more we could say about the wedding. I think, though, however, what has been said here should provide you with a good start in performing this ministry responsibility with confidence. Now, let's turn our attention toward baptism and communion. Some denominations refer to these as sacraments, while others refer to them as ordinances, which the Lord Himself instituted. And while the Roman Catholic Church holds to seven sacraments, Protestants see only two, baptism and communion. A few denominations hold to three, and they would add the ordinance of foot washing. Baptism, though not given the importance extended to it in the early church, is a joyous occasion marking the entrance of someone into the kingdom of God. Baptism symbolizes many things which are true of the Christian. First, it symbolizes the washing away of sin. The point of baptism is not physical cleansing, but spiritual cleansing. Second, it symbolizes the death of the old self. Third, it symbolizes being raised in newness of life. Taking someone down under the water signifies the washing away of sin and the death of an old way of life. And bringing the person up out of water symbolizes the newness of life brought about by Christ. Baptism is filled with imagery. Now, it's true that many churches argue over the mode of baptism to the point of disunity. Some sprinkle, some pour, some immerse, and some do other things. Well, which mode is right? The denomination of which I am a part practices immersion. It is felt that this mode of baptism best fits the pattern of the New Testament church, and that it best interprets the Greek word baptizo, and that it best symbolizes the imagery inherent in the ordinance itself. Yet I must say that to be dogmatic about this, to the point of not fellowshipping with others who do differently, really is ludicrous. The commandment is to baptize, not to baptize in a certain mode. By getting all wrapped up in some tangent, Satan keeps us from the central point of baptism. And my point is that the meaning of baptism is far more important than the mode. I think that you should hold to your convictions. Don't misunderstand me. But don't allow them to break fellowship with someone who doesn't necessarily hold to the same mode as you do. Some churches maintain that baptism is necessary for local church membership, while others do not have such a standard. One thing is for certain, baptism has taken a back seat in our society. We find in the Bible that upon confession of faith in Jesus Christ, individuals were immediately baptized. And this is really a far cry from today, where we perform baptisms once or twice a year. Now, I'm not in any way attempting to put a time limit on baptism. I'm only pointing out that our generation has lost the importance and the significance of the act as seen in the small number of baptisms held each year. What importance and significance does your church place upon baptism? Not just in theological thought, but also in practical services.